Hi, I'm Candace Michelle, and this is Our Community. You know, what's been uppermost in all of our minds for the past several weeks is the disaster known as the Chetco Bar Fire, which has affected all of us here in various and life-altering ways. Some people have lost their homes and all of their possessions. Many have faced repeated evacuations as the fire got closer, then slowed, then got closer again as the winds shifted. And all of us have breathed in the unhealthy, smoky air, watched our skies turn the color of dingy pea soup with a red sun and moon, and have dealt with the ongoing fear and uncertainty of this monster fire. As of today, Friday, September 15th, the fire's destruction has grown to almost 190,000 acres and is 38% contained. Here to talk with me about its impact on us as a community is Brookings City Manager Gary Milliman. Thanks, Gary, and welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So, Gary, you've been the city manager for how long?
10 years in July.
Excellent. That's a long time. And I'm sure you've mostly enjoyed it, right?
Yes. It's been a good experience here in Brookings. The city manager jobs and have their ups and downs, but this has been a good experience.
Have you ever experienced anything like this before?
Have not experienced a wildfire or a disaster on this scale that has affected my own community. I worked for 18 years as a reservist with FEMA, where I went to disaster-impacted communities and worked with the people there.
I didn't know that.
And I've also been in communities that have experienced earthquakes and some other events, but nothing that has involved a potential evacuation and a threat to the community like this one has.
And I don't think that Brookings itself has ever had anything like this. I don't think any other fire has ever gotten this close.
I don't know. I've had people tell me that they recall reading about fires that burned to the coast.
Wow.
But I have not done a historical check.
Right. Yeah. I can't imagine. It's to have that fire coming towards you, just marching towards you, and it's like, how do you even stop it? How do you make it stop?
It was moving fast for several days there, really had us worried when it was moving at about 5 miles a day.
Yeah, that's a lot. I know. So what we know is that it started in the Calmeopsis Wilderness on July 15th, they think, with a lightning strike. So when and how did the city find out about the fire?
Well, for me, I had heard about it as a lightning strike that had occurred about 25 miles east of the city, and there were a lot of lightning strikes that occurred at the time and started small fires, so really didn't give it much attention. And then we were asked to meet with the Forest Service District Ranger and a couple of Forest Service firefighters on July 21st. They provided us with a briefing. I think the fire was around 500 acres at that time.
Which is growing, obviously. But not huge. 500 acres 25 miles away is not, that doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah, it did not raise an immediate concern with us. And they told us that it was in the wilderness area, that they were not able to really get in and effectively address the fire because of the geography, and that they had some limitations on resources to be able to address it. And their plan was to develop a what they call an indirect line, which is a fire line that they construct beyond where the fire is burning, and then prepare for the fire to burn to them so that they can then deal with it more effectively.
But the line that they would prepare would be, in essence, to stop that fire once it got there. Yeah, and then what happened?
Well, I really presume that they went ahead with their plan and didn't hear too much more about it until about a month later, about August 17th, we were contacted by the Forest Service and some other agencies indicating that the fire has really gotten quite large and was moving faster to the west. And they wanted to utilize our emergency operating center as a point of organizing their firefighting effort. So we opened the EOC.
Now, the 17th would have been probably the day before the big blow up.
Yeah, I think it was the 17th or the 18th.
Okay.
That it was about 15,000 acres at that mm-hmm. time.
And then, yeah.
And it jumped to 40 something
yes.
and then to 90.
I remember that.
Within the next
day
couple
very,
of days.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was, I think, a shock to everyone, that a rapid advance backed by the wind coming west. And
I'm curious about that. It's like, you know, well, I was going to say, does the Forest Service not understand Chetco effects? But I imagine that they were doing the best that they possibly could at the time. And
really can't comment on what internally they were talking about that
right.
was not shared with us, although we were sharing with them
right.
Local knowledge, because with few exceptions, those who were here as a part of the incident management team were not from here. They're
right.
from all over the United States, North Carolina and other places. So they sent in a National Incident Management Organization, which I had never heard of before, but it's apparently a interdepartmental national team that is on reserve. They're kind of a reserve corps that gather together and manage major incidents, primarily wildfires, as I understand it. So they came in from a variety of places, and we worked with them to familiarize them with the area, what the Chetco effect is, what impacts the marine layer may have, just a variety of things, you know, where Second Bridge is.
Yeah, right.
Those are
important information.
Those
yeah.
local activities.
And you were in the EOC.
Right, the Emergency Operations Center there across the parking lot from the police station.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty well outfitted. I mean, that's what you have designated to use in terms of, you know, if disasters and...
That's right. Yeah, this was really the first real-time test for that facility, and not only the building, but all the systems that we've installed mm-hmm. there, and the training that we've done with our people. It all came together to be put us in a position of being able to support this sudden influx of folks coming in from a variety of different agencies.
Which is great, because if that hadn't been in place, it could have very easily been chaos.
Indeed, it could have been.
Yeah, more chaos than right. there already was. So let's say the 18th, 19th kind of thing, everybody sort of showed up. When was the conflagration that kind of happened around the 19th?
Yeah, I think it was about the 19th. I don't recall the exact date,
right.
but that was an important aspect of this. Chief Jim Watson, who, in addition to being the Brookings fire chief, is the county fire chief.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he was in contact with the state fire marshal,
mm-hmm.
And they were great to work with on coming up with the necessary documentation to request a conflagration declaration by the state. And that was approved by the governor, and that triggered sending in primarily structural fire crews from all over the state and beyond. So I think at one time we had 400 or so structural firefighters. They're here. Structural being their equipment and their training is designed for them to put out a structural fire. They're not wildfire firefighters. Mm-hmm. So the wildfire firefighters came in through the efforts of the Forest Service and the Coos Forest Protective Association and Oregon Department of Forestry. They all coordinated bringing in the wildfire firefighters, and those are the folks who are here now, the wildfire
firefighters. Because we've sort of gotten to the point where we think the structures are pretty well protected.
Right. The immediate threat to the city and the areas that are where structures exist, that has diminished greatly. So they did a lot of work. The structural fire protection contingent did a lot of work while they were in town. They weren't just sitting around waiting for the buildings to burn. Once they got here, they went out and did triage through many of the neighborhoods in the city and in the unincorporated area, looking at many houses. I think they looked at 1,000 houses.
Wow.
And looked at them to make a determination as to their capacity for surviving a wildfire if it came into that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And they actually did work like cleaning rain gutters and sweeping roofs and limbing bushes and relocating piles of firewood and setting up pools, filling them with water, having pumps and hose at the ready, putting sprinkler systems on roofs, getting those houses that they felt needed additional protection ready for the fire that might come flying through the air. So they did a lot of work there. They patrolled the community, and they were here for the protection of the city and the outlying area where there are structures. And the need for them has diminished, so they have all gone home. And that part of the activity is now back in the hands of the local fire department.
Great. And I think one of the biggest concerns was because the winds were up, that the embers were able to travel great distances.
Yes, they were almost a mile. Seems like I heard 0.7 miles or so on some of those days when it got into a treetop and went along the treetops and blew for some distance and then ignited whatever it hit. There were a number of those days when the humidity, relative humidity, was very low. I think one day was almost at zero. I heard things like 7% or 15% or something like that, which means that it's virtually anything would ignite it.
Right.
So that was really the greatest concern, the wind and blowing the fire into neighborhoods.
I remember going out, I think the first day that I was really scared, which was probably Saturday, and I went out and the ash was, of course, all over my car. But what was most appalling to me was seeing these whole burned leaves in my yard. And I live next to the ocean. So they were coming from miles away.
They were falling in the police station parking lot and at my house on Parkview Drive. Burned leaves and clumps of burned leaves. I even brought in a large piece that I found in my home parking lot to have the firemen help me figure out what it was. And they said it looked like tan oak bark, a big chunk of bark that had burned on a tan oak tree and blown off. And
I mean, when you think about that, right, it's first of all, it's this big amount of stuff, and it has to burn really fast and then get shot up into the air and then get shot along the air currents for
miles,
right? It's just, and what if it were burning as it was being shot? I mean, it's just the what ifs are,
That's why we were very concerned. The fire was advancing quickly there for several days, and it was getting, coming down into an area where it was advancing on parts of the city.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with, or our police department worked with Chris Wallace and Donnie Dotson in our police department, and others, the sergeants as well, worked with the sheriff's department and the Oregon State Police to develop an evacuation plan for the city.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we never had to implement it. There are remnants of that plan that you can see around. If you drive southbound, just as you approach the Chetco River Bridge, there's a pile of large orange cones and signs on the shoulder of the highway that were prepared for closing the highway to one-way traffic south. But fortunately, we didn't have to go there. We had developed neighborhoods within the city and prioritized them based upon the advance of the fire and the condition of the neighborhoods in terms of accessibility. We do have some neighborhoods in town that have narrow streets. The evacuation is primarily to get people out to safety, but also to be able to allow firefighters unimpeded access to save structures and respond to emergencies. So,
and some of that is difficult. If you've got narrow streets, they can't turn around. I mean, the rigs are big and...
Right. So we were watching it closely, slept with my radio a few nights, as did others.
Yes.
And, so we worked very closely. I mean, in the EOC, Sheriff Ward was seated right next to Chief Wallace.
Right.
And they collaborated the entire time they were there, not only on city issues, but on issues related to the unincorporated area. And we had the OSP in the room, as well as representatives of various fire agencies and public information officers.
Now, were there people in the EOC sort of 24/7? Was it staffed like all the time, or did people actually go home and get some sleep?
Well, people did go home. I wouldn't say it was entirely 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we had the call center there.
Oh, that's where the call center was.
It may have been.
Okay.
Initially, that's where the call center was, and then they expanded into the council chambers.
I'm sorry, really?
we had quite a few in the call center.
Wow.
Including four city lifeguards who, when the ash started coming down, we closed the pool.
Right, right.
Because we couldn't keep it in service.
Right.
So we repurposed four of the lifeguards to work in the call center.
Wow.
And that worked out really well because they turned out to be the only people in the call center at the time that had local knowledge.
Right.
So they did a great job.
Good. Good. Yeah, I'm sure that people stepped up to the plate in ways that they had no knowledge of or intention to. And, you know, you get drafted and that's just what happens. You know, you're in an emergency and you do what you need to do. Yeah. So your staff obviously was involved in all of this stuff.
In many ways.
Mm-hmm.
We have Jordan Fanning, who's our GIS and EOC coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
And he was probably the guy working there. He was the most popular guy.
He's a nice guy.
Because he has really extraordinary GIS talents. And so for the first number of days, he was producing all of the maps.
Wow.
The data was coming into him because the other agencies hadn't brought out their GIS people in yet. So he was getting the data and producing the maps, the evacuation maps and the fire spread maps and any kind of graphic that was needed. He did a great job putting those together, and he was a much sought after individual for at least a couple of weeks. They were always chasing him down. Then the public works crew, they assisted with putting up some roadblocks when the evacuation time came. They made adjustments in the water department to make sure that the water storage tanks remained full. You know, our water storage tanks, what happens is that as they draw down, there's a point at which they draw down when it triggers a refilling.
Right.
So we had to modify them so that we didn't have that drawdown.
Because you wanted to keep them full.
Wanted to keep them full. So we had to go to manual and had have people out doing that. And then we checked every fire hydrant in town. Valves on every fire hydrant to make sure they were working. Mm-hmm. Found some that didn't work. Mm-hmm. So we made field repairs on those. Mm-hmm. So our public works department was very much engaged as well.
Mm-hmm. It must have just been crazy. I mean, really, you know, just.
We very much played a support role. And of course, our police department was involved with evacuation notifications and assisting the sheriff's office. Our dispatch center, we had to double up people because of the call volume coming in to the 911 center.
Now, what about the airport? Was the airport being used at all? I mean, was it possible to get air support in?
Sure. Initially, it was not. And they had many days when they couldn't use air to attack the fire because of the smoke. And then when the marine layer moved in, because of the marine layer. Mm-hmm. So the weather conditions really had a role to play in their ability to use an air attack. Initially, they were not using the Brookings Airport. I think it was all coming out of Medford. Mm-hmm. Today, they have two helicopters, two of the 12 helicopters that are in operation today are based at the Brookings Airport.
There are 12 helicopters involved now?
Right.
Wow. So really, you know, I mean, we all kind of know that the airport is something that we should have, and it really helps us a lot. But clearly this underscored the need to have some kind of a functioning airport.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the other thing that I thought was very interesting was that it had just been a few days previously that we had been, there was that panel discussion about the hospital and emergency room and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And like 2 days later, we have this fire blow up, mm-hmm. which if that wasn't an underscore again of that we really need to look to our own, because if that fire had come down and very easily could have cut us off in both the north and the south, I mean, it could have been so much worse.
Yeah, I can't say enough that we need that emergency room open now.
Like yesterday.
I was monitoring fire calls, and of course the fire channel is also where you hear the ambulance calls. Mm-hmm. Might be interesting to check with CalOr, but at least on one day I heard a number of smoke-related mm-hmm. Ambulance calls, mm-hmm. and those folks went to either Sutter or Gold Beach rather than here.
Right. And another way that the city got involved in this was that you ended up having to house firefighters, right? Didn't they end up at the high school at least for a while?
Yes. Primarily the structural firefighters were located at the high school for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Then the wildfire firefighters were located at the port. And then the two camps were consolidated in the new camp down on Ocean View Drive. So the National Incident Management Organization worked with the school district to acquire the use of the field at the school, and also to acquire the use of the facilities for community meetings.
That's right. There were several community meetings. Yeah. And one of the things that I noticed and that I thought was great, I didn't leave my computer for probably a week. I mean, I would go and take little naps and stuff, but the social media was great. I mean, it was the way that a lot of us kept in touch with what was happening, you know, how big the fire was growing, and we could go to websites and actually see the infrared pictures of the heat and what it was doing. And we would get the alerts either by our phone or over the computer about, you know, where you were in terms of the evacuation and, you know, what you needed to know about. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, that was a huge bonus for us to be able to have that kind of information.
I think that was a big help. Of course, there was some information going out on social media that was not accurate.
Yes. I think that's the nature of the beast.
You know, we had to deal with some of those.
Right.
But one of the early things that this National Incident Management Organization did was bring in a public information team. And one member of that public information team did nothing but social media.
Wow.
Facebook okay. and Twitter and all mm-hmm. of that. And she was in the EOC for about 2 weeks, and that was her complete assignment, was to push information out on social media. So wow. I think that was a great start.
Well, she did a great job, yeah. And it really helped those of us who had no other way of finding out what was happening, you know, to kind of stay on top of it. And I think that, you know, some of us that were not in level two or level threes had people in our homes that had been evacuated. Right. And, you know, they also needed to know, you know, is my home A, still there? B, has it moved from level three to level two so I can go back and at least check on it? And that was the other thing that kept happening, was that the evacuation levels kept changing depending right. on the wind. So, you know, we had people in our house several times.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion between fire and sheriff and law enforcement on the evacuations. Sheriff was trying to get people back into their homes as quickly as safely possible.
Of course.
So he was working really closely with the fire mm-hmm. management to just try to analyze when is the safe time to get people back. A number of people moved back in to level three area or stayed.
Yeah, I think there were a few who even didn't leave.
So
yeah.
they were concerned about their homes and
right.
didn't feel perhaps that they had a place to go.
Right.
So that it's something that fire and police and sheriff primarily worked with closely.
You know, and it's part of who we are here too. You know, there's a real streak of independence and, you know, I'm going to do it my way kind of thing that is part of our community. And, you know, it's actually a very valuable part of our community, I think. But yeah. It can be a little bit nerve-wracking if your job is to make sure that people are out of their homes and safe. If people won't leave, then it's
a hard decision to make to put people out of their homes.
Yes.
I can tell you from this experience.
And,
but it's just a hard call to make, because you know what the ramifications are.
Yeah.
They need to decide what to take, what to leave behind. You're creating a lot of anxiety in their lives. But it's the right thing to do to protect their safety.
Well, I think part of it is that we were not at all prepared. I mean, it's funny how you think you are thinking about what would happen in a disaster, but the truth is we were not prepared. I'm talking about the people. You guys at the city level, you know, you had some preparation, but us, it's like I'm sitting there going, really, what if I'm evacuated? What does that actually mean? What do I need to start grabbing? And when should I start grabbing it? I mean, I'm at a level one now, but if that fire jumps those lines, and there's no guarantee it won't, how soon am I going to have to be out? And it's just, yeah, it's...
A lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, we hadn't really talked about the prospect of a wildfire coming into this close to the community. And I just pictured on the counter behind where I typically would sit at the EOC is a stack of yellow tape. It says evacuation or line do
right.
not cross.
Right.
And most of those tapes say tsunami evacuation line do
yes.
not cross.
Yes. which, you know, obviously is exactly opposite from fire. Opposite direction, opposite. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so we've been practicing a lot on the tsunami side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one lesson learned from this is that there are other risks that we need to be prepared for.
That's right. And actually, the wildfire risk is something that we potentially look at every single year, which is somewhat different from the tsunami. I mean, that's something that would just kind of happen out of the blue and we're not going to know. But the wildfires are really something that we can, in fact, count on, because they happen every single summer in some way, shape, or form. I mean, this year has obviously been outrageous. It looks like all of Oregon is burning.
Yeah, seems to occur with more frequency.
Yeah, and bigger and nastier. So how would you say that the city of Brookings has been impacted by this? I mean, clearly there were some structures lost. Clearly, there was one account that I saw on Facebook that 11 structures up on Gardner Ridge, Kate Road, that area, were lost. So that's the obvious one, which is devastating to the people like the Worldtons and, you know, people who've lost their homes. But there are other impacts as well.
Sure, and I'm not sure I say with confidence that there are impacts that we don't yet know.
Yeah.
I think we can reasonably assume that there will be impacts on the timber industry. Last report I had was about 9,000 acres of South Coast Lumber Company land was impacted by the fire.
And this is huge because they are one of the biggest employers in the area.
Yes.
And without the lumber, they have nothing to work with.
Right. You know, there are areas on other federally owned lands that would be available for timber production as well. And how were those areas affected? And at what stage of growth were all of those trees? And there may not be an impact today, but there might be along about the time those trees were to reach maturity.
Right.
So that's an impact that we need to review. I think the impact on the fishery is something that may become evident. There are a number of streams that were damaged by the fire and will be damaged most likely by the runoff from the fire. Concern about siltation of the creeks and the rivers and how that affects salmon spawning and salmon return.
Well, especially because the salmon do return to the place that they were spawned. So if that is gone now or silted in or destroyed, where do they go? Where do those poor salmon go?
Yeah, I don't know how they deal with that in the natural mm-hmm. environment, but that's a question that we've raised mm-hmm. and I think needs to be addressed. And of course, there's the recreational aspect of it. We're not sure at this point what damage has been done really to the recreational aspects of the forest. I personally haven't been out to places like Redwood Bar or Miller Bar to look and see what the impacts are there. I've seen some aerial footage of forested areas that have been burned, and all you can see is the trail. How is all that going to impact tourism, our own recreation
mm-hmm.
by people who live here? And how's that going to affect people who are thinking about living here,
mm-hmm.
who would be moving here in part because of those recreational and scenic amenities? So I think all of that, and of course, has a residual on other aspects of the business community and on
people like
who
got hit a lot, you know. I mean,
right.
You look at what our money makers are. It's the timber, so okay, that got a big hit. It's the fishing. Okay, that took a huge hit. It's the tourists.
Right.
That took a huge hit. I mean, it feels like we lost our tourism season this year because we lost half of August and we've lost all of September, really. You know, it's just, who wants to come here?
Right. And that's a question going forward as well, not just this year, but also going forward. And that's why we, the city, is seeking to partner with Curry County and obtain funding through the federal agencies to do a economic impact analysis of the fire, which would also identify steps that need to be taken going forward to recover. We don't know what that impact is. We can't document it. It's anecdotal. It's speculative, but we need to define it. And then as a part of that, identify where we go from here.
And what would that look like, getting that kind of an assessment done?
I think it would involve interaction with a number of members of the community, with foresters, with hydrologists, with fishery specialists, just a number of people to get an assessment as to what the impact is expected to be. Without that, we can't plan for the recovery.
And you know, the other thing that occurs to me is that certainly there is the economic impact and, you know, financially how hard hit we are and all of that. But there's also the emotional impact, and I'm not sure that even can be measured, but certainly it's going to be significant.
Well, absolutely. Of course, right now it's the topic of every conversation everywhere.
Yeah.
In the community, I had I was able today to go out with our staff and award someone the Yard of the Month. Beautiful.
Amazing how life still goes on
in their yard, and the neighborhood nominated this individual Night. For the Yard of the Month. So they had a party at her house, lemonade and cookies, and the topic of conversation in that beautiful yard was the fire.
Yeah,
where we go from here, and Why did all of this happen? And so it's a it'll be a hot topic, and it will affect people whose lives have been interrupted or in some cases changed forever.
Well, I think that anybody who's lost anything in this fire, their life will never be the same. I mean, if you've lost a home, or if you've lost your barn, or if you've lost your cars, or, you know, your livestock, your life will never be the way it was. You will have to rebuild in some way, shape, or form. You know, I was amazing to me how life does continue on in spite of being in the middle of a disaster. You know, everyday life does actually continue. And I was called for jury duty this past week. And one day I actually had to go up to Gold Beach and, you know, sit there to be maybe a member of the jury. And when I left Brookings, the air was clean, pretty clean. We were getting breeze from the ocean. It was pretty clean. I got up as far as Pistol River, and it was like it was smoke all over again. And it was kind of that, oh no, it's still there. It's not like this fire is gone. It's not gone. It's over that hill right there. And it's kind of this funny juxtaposition of, you know, your ordinary life somehow continues in a state of unreality almost.
Yeah, the event is not over. The smoke has cleared for the most part in Brookings, but I drove today down to Smith River, and there's a good amount of smoke in that area as well. So,
well, and I noticed there was more smoke in the air today than there was yesterday.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether that has to do with the winds changing again, or the fire has moved or I don't know what, but it was definitely smokier today than it was yesterday.
And speaking of Smith River, I need to give a shout out to the Tallawa Dene Nation.
Yes.
They took in a lot of evacuees into the old ship ashore
yep.
RV park. I think one day they told me they had 140 people staying in RVs, and they were providing them with free breakfast and dinner, utilities, with the exception of electricity, free showers, free laundry, and they had some folks staying in the facility itself that didn't have an RV. And they just told us that they were going to continue with that as long as they needed to, as long as people were out of their homes. I think they received some reimbursement from Red Cross in the early days, but continued to provide the same service even after the reimbursement was no longer forthcoming. So they just did they stepped up to be a part of this community by providing a need that was not being addressed at the time.
Yeah, I'm so grateful to them. It really was. And there are so many people in the community that have really stepped up. And, you know, there's been so many different efforts coordinated to help people. And, you know, the food bank was having emergency hours so that you could come in right. and, you know, get food if you needed. People were collecting clothing. You know, just every time you turn around, there was somebody else that was going out of their way to step up and say, yes, let's help. Let's do what we can to make it a little bit easier on the people who are most severely impacted from this. So going forward, we're looking at some federal assistance, maybe? What do you think?
Well, we don't know. Mm-hmm. We received information yesterday that we may be able to recover a part of our costs associated with assisting with the fire.
Part of our costs.
Right. It's a 75% program.
Okay.
we think we should be receiving more than that.
I would think so. It wasn't our fire, was it?
Right. I don't believe that there's been a federal disaster declaration yet.
Oh.
I'm not sure what the status of that is.
Who has to do that?
That's a request that needs to go from the state of Oregon to FEMA.
So basically the governor would be making that request?
The governor's office would make that request.
Okay.
And then the president would need to sign a declaration.
Okay.
So I don't know what the status of that is or how they're planning to structure that, whether they're going to try to pursue a declaration for this event, or speculation is that they might try to wrap a number of fires.
Because
together.
There are quite a few fires in Oregon right now, bad ones. Yeah.
So that remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
So you're waiting to see what kinds of federal assistance might be available to the victims of it, and to help
and the
us.
Town,
in the
right?
town,
right? I mean, there's a lot that needs to be replaced or will need to be replaced. I mean, I what's going to happen when the rain starts? I mean, right. other than the great news that the fire will be put out. But, you know, there's some concern, I would think, about some of the stuff that's not going to hold.
Oh, sure. Slides on roads, dealing with that. You know, both the city and harbor take their potable water supply from the Chetco River. And what will this siltation do to those facilities? Well, both of us have facilities that are beneath the bed of the river and have a natural filtration But what will the impact be of a lot of siltation entering the river? We don't know.
Has there been any effect so far? But there probably hasn't been a lot of siltation, so.
No, nothing.
Yeah. Right. We're really not going to know about that until the rain starts.
We won't know until we're into the rainy season.
Mm-hmm. Right? So theoretically, siltation would mean that the silt would build up on top of that natural filtration on the bed of the river and make it much harder.
That would be, that's the concern.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So what kind of things are you hoping to do in the future to maybe make us more resilient, the city? Is there anything that we can do to kind of, I mean, I'm thinking that a lot of homes that got some assistance in terms of weed whacking and mm-hmm. cleaning the gutters and all. I mean, that sort of says that we weren't prepared at all for the idea of a wildfire.
Yeah, they treated about 500 homes.
So what does that say about where we should be going in terms of...
Yeah, I think we need to be doing more public education, more mm-hmm. public outreach.
Mm-hmm.
To folks on what fire safety is in
mm-hmm. And defensible space. I mean, does anybody really know what defensible space is?
So, yeah, I think that type of an education program needs to come out. I think, you know, perhaps a lot of people have presumed that we're so close to the coast, so influenced by the marine environment, that a fire is not a hazard here. And that's, you know, even the coast here had some very low humidity days during the course of this fire. So we need to be doing more public education on that. We've identified some work that the city needs to do along with our partner fire districts to better prepare us for addressing a fire when it occurs. Both in our water system and improvements in our fire department's equipment and response capability.
You need actually different equipment, don't you, for the fire department?
Right. We have two very fine fire engines. They're primarily structural fire engines, and our fire chief has recommended that we look into acquiring at least one what's called a brush truck in many mm-hmm. Circles, one that could be used in a wildfire situation. So we're going to need to look at that. We've got some work to do on the water system to make sure we have adequate pumping capacity. People ask me, well, there's no water shortage. Why should we have water conservation? But when you have 4 million gallons in storage, and if you crank up 20 fire engines drafting from fire hydrants, 20 or more, you don't need a water shortage. That you've just created one.
Exactly.
So we need to make sure that we have the capacity to be able to address that need if it occurs in the future.
Because I think that, you know, people forget that you're not planning for the norm. We already have the norm taken care of. What you're planning for is the disaster that you don't know is coming. And if you're not prepared for that, you're going down. And, you know, it'll take that much longer to come back from it.
So hopefully there is some form of a declaration, federal declaration, which mm-hmm. would enable businesses that have been adversely affected to get some financing. They're, to my knowledge, after spending about 20 years with FEMA in working with disaster-affected communities, there is no program to make you whole. Huh. There are loan programs.
Wow.
So if you, for example, have lost your home to the disaster, you can borrow to replace your home, But of course, the fire may have destroyed your home, but it didn't destroy your mortgage.
Oh, no.
So there are a lot of things to come into play here. People need to review their insurance policies to make sure that they're covered for an event like this. I've had a conversation with the state insurance commissioner who told me that many policies, in fact, he believed that almost all policies have a provision that if you're in a level 3 evacuation area, there's some coverage for out-of-pocket expenses while you're out of your home.
Good news.
A lot of people don't think about that.
Right.
People need to be interacting with their insurance companies. They need to realize that even if there is a federal declaration, it's not going to make you whole. It'll help you recover. It's predominantly low-interest financing and loan programs. You should also talk to your tax people about casualty losses and things of that nature as a result of the damage you suffered, either through loss of sales or physical damage. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of programs that could become available if there is a federal declaration that would help greatly.
But unless or until there's that federal declaration, those programs would not be available?
The federal programs are not, but folks can still talk about to their tax consultant about mm-hmm. How to deal with the IRS. They may actually be able to assist with that or with their insurance providers. And I'm sure there'll be other programs that will surface. I know some individual banks, I know there's one local bank, it's a small program, but they're making $2,500 loans available to their bank members at 1.9% interest.
And right.
So, you know, there may be other programs out there as well.
The fire did actually start on federal land, though, right?
Yes, in the Kelmeopsis Wilderness. A lightning mm-hmm. strike is reported as the cause.
So while it's not really, you know, good news, nevertheless, it's federal land. So if there is kind of a responsible person, it would be the feds.
Well, that's a good question. And a part of what the city has asked of its legislative representatives, Senators Merkley and Wyden and Congressman DeFazio, is to conduct a review of how this fire started and what how it progressed and what actions were taken or not taken to mitigate the fire, to knock it down. There are a lot of folks in the community I've heard from that have a gap in their understanding of what happened. How did we get here? How did this fire travel 22 and a half miles?
Without anybody noticing. or without anybody saying, this has to stop now.
There may be perfectly good and understandable yes. explanations mm-hmm. about that. It may have been, maybe from a natural phenomenon or a series of them.
Mm-hmm. But we need to know.
But we need to know.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
The people who are responsible for answering those questions are not the firefighters that are here now.
No, they don't know. Right.
Their sole focus is now on knocking this fire out.
Yeah.
But the people that should be asked those questions are your federal legislative representatives who are responsible for providing oversight and the people who the firefighters work for at the U.S. Forest Service and in their management.
So I think people are really concerned that those questions are not going to be asked and answered. I think that's kind of the undercurrent that I pick up in the community is, you know, they're afraid that because what they keep hearing is it's not time to ask those questions now, they're afraid that those questions aren't going to be asked.
It's coming. Mm-hmm. The time is coming. Mm-hmm. I believe the Forest Service has made a commitment to hold some community meetings on that topic. Not sure when. They haven't seen the dates yet. But the time is now coming shortly.
Good. And I've noticed that we've had, you know, dignitaries in town at least twice that I know of. The governor's been here. So
governor's been here twice. Mm-hmm. Senator Wyden's been here. The Oregon commander of the National Guard has been here. And the chief of the U.S. Forest Service from Washington, D.C., was here about 3 weeks after he was appointed. So some high-level people have been here, and more are coming.
Good.
This week.
So we're not being ignored.
Congressman DeFazio was in that group as well. So,
and that was just like last weekend.
That was last Sunday.
Yeah.
And this weekend we have more people scheduled to come.
Great. So it's really we are not being ignored.
That's right.
And they're seeing firsthand what our issues are, what our problems are. So they can't possibly at any point say, well, we didn't understand.
Right.
Right. Yeah. There's not really much more that can be done other than, you know, to keep after them after they go home to make sure that they don't forget us.
That's right.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you'd like to, you know, tell people or?
Sure. I really want to thank the community for coming together on this. There's been a lot of people-to-people activity in the community, people taking care of people, and that has been great to see. It's not just government's responsibility to deal with incidents like this. The larger role is people taking care of people, and that's been in evidence in our community. And so from government to the people, I thank you.
Yeah, I've been very impressed. I've been very impressed with people really reaching out and really asking what they can do to help and volunteering. And I mean, it's just been, it is what I think this community is. I mean, every time we have something happen, people step up to the plate. It's one of the reasons why we love living here.
So, indeed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Gary, thank you so much for coming in and giving us this interview. We're about out of time. And we're still in uncertain times. So my advice is that everybody stays alert and make sure you know what's going on. And I would like to invite you back in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks or so, okay, to give us an update on where we're at with it and what's happened.
Oh, very good.
Great. Thank you. This has been Our Community, and my guest today has been Brookings City Manager Gary Milliman talking about the Chetco Bar Fire. Stay safe. Keep being kind to each other. We're an amazing community. This is Candace Michelle. For music credits for the preceding show, go to kciw.org/credits.